his long legs stretched out under the table. For some time now, one of them had been resting against hers. She had thought fleetingly that she should move it, and hadn't, and now she couldn't without it looking as if she was making a point. She felt it, an electric presence against her bare leg. She quite liked it. Because something had happened somewhere between the pie and chips in the last round, and it wasn't just drink. She wanted Mr. Nichols not to feel angry and hopeless. She wanted to see that big, sleepy grin of his, the one that seemed to diffuse all the suppressed anger spread across his face. "You know, I've never met anyone like you," he said, gazing at the table. Jess had been about to make a joke about cleaners and baristas and staff, but instead she just felt this great lurch in the pit of her belly and found herself picturing the taut V of his bare torso in the shower. And then she wondered what it would be like to have sex with Mr. Nichols. The shock of this thought was so great that she nearly said it out loud. "I think it would be quite nice to have sex with Mr. Nichols." She looked away and gulped the remaining half glass of wine, feeling the burn of complaint as it went down. Mr. Nichols was looking at her. "Don't take offence. I meant it in a good way." "I'm not taking offence." Her ears had gone pink. "You're just the most positive person I've ever met. You're practical. You fix stuff. You never seem to feel sorry for yourself. Every obstacle that comes your way, you just scramble over it. Ripping my trousers and falling over in the process. But you keep going. When someone helps me..." "Okay, this simile is becoming confusing." He took a swig of his beer. "I just wanted to tell you. I know it's nearly over, but I've enjoyed this trip. More than I expected to." It was out before she knew what she was saying. "Yeah, me too." They sat. He was gazing at her leg. She wondered if he was thinking what she was thinking. "Do you know something, Jess?"
"What?"
"You've stopped fidgeting." They looked up at each other, and a question passed silently between them. She wanted to look away, but she couldn't. Mr. Nichols had just been a means of moving forward out of an impossible mess. Now all Jess could see were his big, dark eyes, the way his hair left his forehead in an impossibly thick, lush line, the hypnotic way his top lip sculpted itself into a tiny cradle.
"You need to get back on the horse."
He looked away first.
"Wow, look at the time. It's late. We really should get some sleep. You said we had to get up early."
His voice was just a bit too loud.
"Yep, nearly 11 already. I think I calculated that we need to leave here by 7 to make it there for midday. Does that sound right to you?"
Sure. She swayed a little when she stood up and reached for his arm, but he'd already moved away. They arranged an early breakfast, bade Mrs. Deakins a slightly too hearty good night, and made their way slowly up the stairs at the back of the pub. Jess was barely aware of what was said, for she was acutely conscious of him behind her, of the unsteady way her hips moved when she walked, of her bare shoulders. "Is he watching me?" Her mind swirled and dipped in unexpected directions. She wondered briefly what it would feel like if he were to lean forward and kiss her bare shoulder. She thought she might have made a small, involuntary sound at the thought of it. They stopped on the landing, and she turned to face him. It felt as if, 3 days in, she'd only just seen him. "Good night, then. Jessica Ray Thomas, with an A and an E." Her hand came to rest on the door handle. She gazed up at him then, at his broad shoulders and his clean, identikit T-shirt and his soft, sad eyes. And her breath caught in her throat. It had been so long. Would it really be such a bad idea? She pushed down on the handle and leant in. "I'll see you in the morning. I'd offer to make you coffee, but you're always up first anyway." She didn't know what to say. It was possible she was just gazing at him. Jess?
"What?"
"Thanks. For everything. The sickness stuff, the birthday surprise. In case I don't get a chance to say this tomorrow..." He gave her a lopsided smile. "As ex-wives go, you were definitely my favourite." Jess tried to smile back, but her answer dried in her throat. She pushed at the door.
She was going to say something else, but she was distracted by the fact that the door didn't move. She turned and pushed down on the handle again. It gave, opened an inch, and no more.
What?
I can't open the door, she said, putting both her hands on it. Nothing. Mr. Nichols walked over and pushed. It gave the tiniest amount. It's not locked, he said, working the handle. There's something blocking it. She squatted down, trying to see, and Mr. Nichols turned on the landing light. Through the 2 inches of door space, she could just make out Norman's bulk on the other side of the door. He was lying on the mattress, his huge back to her.
Norman, she hissed. Move!
Nothing.
Norman!
If I push, he'll have to wake up, right? Mr. Nichols began leaning on the door. He rested his full weight on it, then he pushed.
Jesus Christ, he said.
Jess shook her head. You don't know my dog. He let go of the handle and the door shut with a gentle click. They stared at each other. Well, he said finally. There are 2 beds in here. It'll be fine. She grimaced. Norman is sleeping on the other single. I moved the mattress in there earlier. He looked at her wearily then. Knock on the door?
Tansy is stressed. I can't run the risk of waking her. It's fine. I'll just sleep on the chair.
Jess headed down to the bathroom before he could contradict her. She washed and brushed her teeth, gazing at her alcohol-flushed skin in the plastic-framed mirror and trying to stop her thoughts chasing themselves in circles. When she arrived back at the room, Mr. Nichols was holding up one of his dark grey T-shirts. Here, he said, and threw it at her as he walked past to the bathroom. Jess changed into it, trying to ignore the vague eroticism of its clean male smell, pulled the spare blanket and a pillow out of the wardrobe, and curled up in the chair, struggling to bring her knees up to a position that made it comfortable. It was going to be a long night. Some minutes later, Mr. Nichols opened the door and turned off the overhead light. He was wearing a white T-shirt and a pair of dark blue boxers. She saw that his legs bore the long, visible muscles of someone who does no excuses exercise. She knew immediately how they would feel against her own. The thought made her mouth go dry. The little bed sagged audibly as he climbed in. Are you comfortable like that? He looked at her over the lavender-coloured bedspread.
Totally fine, she said brightly. You?
If one of these springs impales me while I sleep, you have my permission to take the car the rest of the way. He gazed at her across the room for a moment longer, then turned out to the bedside light. The darkness was total. Outside, a faint breeze moaned through unseen gaps in the stone. Trees rustled, and a car door slammed, its engine roaring a protest. In the next room, Norman whined in his sleep, the sound only partially muffled by the thin plasterboard wall. Jess could hear Mr. Nichols breathing, and although she had spent the previous night only inches from him, she was acutely conscious of his presence in a way she hadn't been 24 hours earlier. She thought of the way he had made Nikki smile, of the way his fingers rested on a steering wheel. She thought of him slumped on the dry stone wall, his head in his hands as he talked about what he had lost, the hurt and anger etched deep on his face. She thought about some expression she had heard Nikki use a few weeks ago. YOLO. You only live once. And remembered how she had told him she thought it was just an excuse idiots use for doing pretty much anything they felt like doing, no matter what the consequences. She thought about Liam, and how she knew in her guts that he was probably having sex with someone right this minute. That ginger barmaid from the Blue Parrot, maybe, or the Dutch girl who drove the flower van. She thought about a conversation she'd had with Chelsea when Chelsea had told her she should lie about her kids because no man would ever fall in love with a single mother of two, and how Jess had got angry with her because deep down she knew she was probably right. She thought about the fact that even if Mr. Nichols didn't go to prison, she would probably never see him again after this trip. And then, before she could think too hard about anything else, Jess eased herself silently out of her chair, letting the blanket fall to the floor. It took only 4 steps to reach the bed, and she hesitated.
her bare toes curled in the acrylic carpet, even then not quite sure what she was doing. You only live once. And then, in the near total dark, there was a faint movement, and she saw Mr. Nichols turn to face her as she lifted the duvet and climbed in. Jess was chest to chest against him, her cool legs against his warm ones. There was nowhere else to go in this tiny bed, with the sag of the mattress pushing them closer together, and its edge like a cliff drop just inches behind her. They were so close that she could breathe in the remnants of his aftershave, his toothpaste. She could feel the rise and fall of his chest as her heart thumped erratically against his. She tilted her head a little, trying to read him. He put his right arm across the duvet, a surprisingly heavy weight, gathering her in closer to him. With his other, he took her hand and enclosed it slowly in his. It was dry and soft, and inches from her mouth, she wanted to lower her face to his knuckles and trace her lips along them. She wanted to reach her mouth up to his and run her teeth gently along the soft curve of his upper lip. You only live once. She lay there, in the dark, paralyzed by her own longing, by the fact that just this once she did not know the answer, or even the question. Do you want to have sex with me? She said, into the darkness. There was a long silence. Did you hear what? Yes, he said. And no. He spoke again before she could turn completely to stone. I just think it would make things too complicated. It's not complicated. We're both young, lonely, a bit pissed. And after tonight, we're never going to see each other again. How so? You'll go back to London, lead your big city life, and I'll be down on the coast leading mine. It doesn't have to be a big deal. He was silent for a minute. Jess, I don't think so. You don't fancy me. She prickled with embarrassment, remembering suddenly what he'd said about his ex. Lara was a model, for Christ's sakes. But even as she shifted away from him, his hand tightened around hers. His voice was a murmur in her ear. You're beautiful. She waited. His thumb brushed over her palm. So, why won't you sleep with me? He didn't say anything. Look, here's the thing. I haven't had sex in 3 years. I sort of need to get back on the horse, and I think it... you would be great. You want me to be a horse? Not like that. I need a metaphorical horse. And now we're back to confusing metaphors. Look, a woman you say you find beautiful is offering you no-string sex. I don't understand the problem. There's no such thing as no-string sex. What? Someone always wants something. I don't want anything from you. She felt him shrug. Not now, maybe. Wow. She turned onto her side. She really got to you, didn't she? Jess slid her foot along his leg. You think I'm trying to lure you in? You think this is me trying to entrap you with my womanly wiles? My womanly wiles, a nylon bedspread, pie and chips. She interlinked her fingers with his. She let her voice drop to a whisper. She felt unleashed, reckless. She thought she might actually faint with how much she wanted him then. I don't want a relationship, Ed, with you or anyone. There's no room in my life for the whole one plus one thing. She tilted her face so that her mouth was inches from his. She could almost taste the toothpaste sweetness of his breath. I'd have thought that would be obvious. He moved his hips an awkward fraction away from hers. You are incredibly persuasive. And you are... She hooked her leg around him, pulling him closer. The hardness of him made her briefly giddy. He swallowed. Her lips were millimeters from his. All the nerves of her body had somehow concentrated themselves in her skin. Or maybe his skin. She could no longer tell. It's the last night. You know, you can drop us off tomorrow and we'll never see each other again. At worst, we can exchange a glance over the vacuum cleaner, and I'll just remember this as a nice night with a nice guy, who actually was a nice guy. She let her lips graze his chin. It carried the faint echo of stubble. She wanted to bite it. You, of course, will remember it as the greatest sex you ever had. And that's it. His voice was thick, distracted. Jess moved closer. That's it, she murmured. You'd have made a great negotiator. Do you ever stop talking? She moved forward a fraction until her lips met his. She almost jolted. She felt the electric pressure of his mouth on hers as he ceded to her, the sweetness of him, and she no longer cared about anything. She wanted him. She burnt with it. Pulled back a fraction. She felt, rather than saw, Ed Nichols gazing at her. His eyes were black in the darkness, unfathomable. He moved his hand, and as it brushed against her stomach, she gave a faint, involuntary shiver. Fuck, he said quietly. Fucking fuck. And then, with a groan, he said, You will actually thank me for this tomorrow. And he gently disentangled himself from her, climbed out of bed, walked over to the chair, sat down, and with a great sigh, hauled the blanket over himself and turned away.
Chapter 20 Ed.
Ed Nichols had thought that spending 8 hours in a damp car park was the worst possible way to spend a night. Then he'd concluded that the worst way to spend a night was hoiking your guts up in a stationary RV somewhere near Derby. He was wrong on both counts. The worst way to spend a night, it turned out, was in a tiny room, a few feet from a slightly drunk, good-looking woman who wanted to have sex with you, and whom you had, like an idiot, rebuffed. Jess fell asleep, or pretended to. It was impossible to tell. Ed sat in the world's most uncomfortable chair, staring out of the narrow gap in the curtains at the black, moonlit sky, his right leg going to sleep, and his left foot freezing cold where it wouldn't fit under the blanket, and tried not to think about the fact that if he hadn't leapt out of bed, he could be there, curled around her right now, her arms around his neck, his lips pressed against her skin, those lithe legs looped around. No. Either A, the sex would have been terrible. They would have been mortified afterwards. And the 5 hours spent travelling to the Olympiad would have been excruciating. Or B, the sex would have been fine. They would have woken up embarrassed, and the journey would still have been excruciating. Worse, they could have ended up with C. The sex would have been off the scale. He slightly suspected this one was correct. He kept getting a hard-on just thinking about her mouth. They would develop feelings for each other, based purely on sexual chemistry, and either D would have to adjust to the fact that they had nothing in common and were just completely unsuited in every other way, or E, they would find they were not entirely unsuited, but then he would be sent to prison. And none of this considered F, which was that Jess had actual kids. Kids who needed stability in their lives, and not someone such as him. He liked children as a concept, but in the same way that he liked the Indian subcontinent, i.e. it was nice to know it existed, but he had no knowledge about it and had never felt any real desire to spend time there. And all this was without the added factor of G, that he was obviously crap at relationships, had only just come out of the two most disastrous examples anyone could imagine, and the odds of him getting it right with someone else on the basis of a lengthy car journey that had begun because he couldn't think how to get out of it were lower than a very low thing indeed. Plus, the whole horse conversation had been frankly weird. And these points could be supplemented by the wilder possibilities that he had completely failed to consider. What if Jess was a psycho, and all that stuff about not wanting a relationship was just a way to reel him in? She didn't seem that sort of girl, sure. But neither had Deanna. Ed sat pondering this and other tangled things, and wishing he could talk a single one of them through with Ronan, until the sky turned orange, then neon blue, and his leg became completely dead, and his hangover, which had formerly manifested itself as a vague tightness at his temples, turned into an emphatic, skull-crushing headache. Ed tried not to look at the girl sleeping in the bed a few feet away, as the outline of her face and body under the duvet became clear in the encroaching light. And he tried not to feel wistful for a time when having sex with a woman you liked had just been about having sex with a woman you liked, and hadn't involved a series of equations so complex and unlikely that probably only Tansy could have got anywhere near understanding them. "Come on, we're running late," Jess shepherded Nikki, a pale, T-shirt-clad zombie, towards the car. "I didn't get any breakfast." "That's because you wouldn't get up when I told you. We'll get you something on the way. Tans? Tansy? Has the dog been to the loo?" The morning sky was the colour of lead and seemed to have descended to a point around their ears. A faint drizzle promised heavier rain. Ed sat in the driving seat as Jess ran around, organising, scolding, promising in a fury of activity. She had been like this since he'd woken, groggily, from what seemed like 20-minute sleep, folding and packing, dragging bags downstairs, supervising breakfast. He didn't think she had met his eye once. Tansy climbed silently into the back seat.
"You okay?"
he yawned, and looked at the little girl in the rearview mirror. She nodded silently. "Nerves." She didn't say anything. "Been sick?" She nodded. "It's all the rage on this trip. You'll be great, really." She gave him the exact look he would have given any adult if they had said the same, then turned to stare out of the window, her face round and pale, her eyes mauve with exhaustion. Ed wondered how late she'd stayed up revising. "Right." Jess shoved Norman into the back seat. He brought with him an almost overwhelming scent of wet dog. She checked that Tansy had done up her belt, climbed into the passenger seat, and finally turned to Ed. Her expression was unreadable. "Let's go." Ed's car no longer looked like his car. In just 3 days, its immaculate cream interior had acquired new scents and stains, a fine sprinkling of dog hair, jumpers and shoes that now lived on seats or wedged underneath them. The floor crunched underfoot with dropped sweet wrappers and crisps. The radio stations were no longer on settings he understood. But something had happened while he had been driving along at 40 miles per hour. The faint sense that he should actually have been somewhere else had begun to fade, almost without him being aware of it. He found himself glancing at the people they passed, buying food, driving their cars, walking their children to and from school, in worlds completely different from his own, knowing nothing of his own little drama several hundred miles south. It made it all seem reduced in size, a model village of problems, rather than something that loomed over him. He drove on, and despite the pointed silence from the woman beside him, Nikki's sleeping face in the rearview mirror, "Teenagers don't really do before 11 o'clock, Tansy explained, and the occasional foul eruptions of the dog, it slowly dawned on him, as they crept closer to their destination, that he was feeling a complete lack of the relief he had expected to feel at the prospect of having his car, his life, back to himself. What he felt was more complex. Ed fiddled with the speakers so that the music was loudest in the rear seats and temporarily silent in the front. "You okay?" Jess didn't look round. "I'm fine." Ed glanced behind him, making sure nobody was listening. "About last night," he began. "Forget it." He wanted to tell her that he regretted it. He wanted to tell her that his body had actually hurt with the effort of not climbing back into that sagging single bed. But what would have been the point? Like she'd said the previous evening, they were two people who had no reason to see each other ever again. "I can't forget it. I wanted to explain..." "Nothing to explain. You were right. It was a stupid idea.
She tucked her legs under her and stared away from him out of the window.
It's just my life is too... Really, it's not an issue. I just...
She let out a deep breath.
I just want to make sure we get to the Olympiad on time. But I don't want us to end it all like this. There's nothing to end.
She put her feet on the dashboard. It felt like a statement.
Let's go. How many miles is it to Aberdeen?
Tansy's face appeared between the front seats.
What, left?
No, from Southampton.
Ed pulled his phone from his jacket and handed it to her. Look it up on the Maps app. She tapped the screen, her brow furrowed.
About 580?
Sounds about right.
So, if we're doing 40 miles an hour, we'd have had to do at least 6 hours driving a day. And if I didn't get sick, we could have done it...
In a day, at a push.
One day.
Tansy digested this, her eyes trained on the Scottish hillsides in the distance ahead.
But we wouldn't have had such a nice time then, would we?
Ed glanced sideways at Jess.
No, we wouldn't.
It took a moment before Jess's gaze slid back towards him.
No, sweetheart, she said after a beat,
and her smile was oddly rueful.
No, we wouldn't.
The car ate the miles sleekly and efficiently. They crossed the Scottish border, and Ed tried, failed, to raise a cheer. They stopped once for Tansy to go to the loo, once 20 minutes later for Nicky to go.
I can't help it, I didn't want to go when Tans did.
And 3 times for Norman, 2 were false alarms. Jess sat silently beside him, checking her watch and chewing at her nails. She was still wearing flip-flops, and he wondered fleetingly if her feet were cold. Nicky gazed groggily out of the window at the empty landscape, at the few flinty houses set into rolling hills. Ed wondered what would happen to him after this was over. He wanted to suggest 50 other things to help him, but he tried to imagine someone suggesting things to him at the same age, and guessed he would have taken no notice at all. He wondered how Jess would keep him safe when they returned home. The phone rang, and he glanced over, his heart sinking.
Lara? Eduardo, baby, I need to talk to you about this roof.
He was aware of Jess's sudden rigidity, the flicker of her gaze. He wished suddenly that he hadn't chosen to answer the call.
Lara, I'm not going to discuss this now. It's not a lot of money, not for you. I spoke to my solicitor, and he says it would be nothing for you to pay for it.
I told you before, Lara, we made a final settlement. He was suddenly conscious of the acute stillness of 3 people in the car.
Eduardo, baby, I need to sort this with you.
Lara, before he could say anything more, Jess reached over and picked up the phone.
Hello, Lara, she said. Jess here. I'm awfully sorry, but he can't pay for your roof, so there's really no point in ringing him any more.
A short silence, then an explosive.
Who is this?
I'm his new wife. Oh, and he'd like his Chairman Mao picture back. Perhaps just leave it with his lawyer, okay? In your own time. Thanks so much.
The resulting silence had the same quality as the few seconds before an atomic explosion. But before any of them could hear what happened next, Jess flipped the off button and handed it back to him. He took it gingerly and turned it off.
Thank you, he said. I think.
You're welcome.
She didn't look at him when she spoke. Ed glanced into his rearview mirror. He couldn't be sure, but he thought Nicky was trying very hard not to laugh. Somewhere between Edinburgh and Dundee, on a narrow wooded lane, they slowed and stopped for a herd of cows in the road. The animals moved around the car, gazing in at its inhabitants with vague curiosity, a moving black sea, eyes rolling in woolly black heads. Norman stared back, his body rigid with silent, confused outrage. Tansy took off her glasses and rubbed her eyes, gazing back at them, half-blind.
Aberdeen Angus, said Nicky.
Suddenly, without warning, Norman hurled his whole body, snarling and growling at the window. The car physically jolted to one side, and his deafening bark bounced off the interior, amplified in the confined space. The back seat became a chaotic mass of arms and noise and writhing dog. Nicky and Jess fought to reach him.
Mom! Norman, stop!
The dog was on top of Tansy, his face hard against the window. Ed could just make out her pink jacket flailing underneath him. Jess lunged over the seat at the dog, grabbing for his collar. They dragged Norman back down from the window. He whined, shrill and hysterical, straining at their grasp, great gobs of drool spraying across the interior.
Norman, you big idiot! What the hell?
He's never seen a cow before.
Tansy, struggling upright, always defending him.
Jesus, Norman!
You okay, Tans? I'm fine.
The cows continued to part around the car, unmoved by the dog's outburst. Through the now steamed-up windows, they could just make out the farmer at the rear, walking slowly and impassively, with the same lumbering gait as his bovine charges. He gave the barest of nods as he passed, as if he had all the time in the world. Norman whined and pulled against his collar.
I've never seen him like that before.
Jess straightened her hair and blew out through her cheeks.
Perhaps he could smell beef.
I didn't know he had it in him, Ed said.
My glasses!
Tansy held up the twisted piece of metal.
Mum! Norman broke my glasses!
It was 10:15.
I can't see anything without my glasses.
Jess looked at Ed.
Shit!
Okay, he said. Grab a plastic bag. I'm going to have to put my foot down. They drove at speed, half frozen, the wind from the open windows a buffeting roar that thwarted conversation. The Scottish roads were wide and empty, and Ed drove so fast that the sat-nav had repeatedly to reassess its timing to their destination. Every minute they gained was an imaginary air punch in his head. Tansy was sick twice. He refused to stop to allow her to vomit into the road.
She's really ill. I'm fine,
Tansy kept saying, her face wedged into a plastic bag.
Really? You don't want to stop, sweetheart? Just for a minute? No. Keep going.
There wasn't time to stop. Not that this made the car journey any easier to bear. Nicky had turned away from his sister, his hand over his nose. Even Norman's head was thrust as far out into the fresh air as he could get it. He would get them there. He knew this as surely as he knew anything. He felt filled with purpose in a way that he hadn't done in months. And as Aberdeen finally loomed before them, its buildings vast and silver-grey, the oddly modern high-rises thrusting into the distant sky, his mind raced ahead of them. He headed for the centre, watched as the roads narrowed and became cobbled streets. They came through the docks, the enormous tankers on their right, and that was where the traffic slowed, and slowly, unstoppably, his confidence began to unravel. They slowed, and then sat in an increasingly anxious silence, Ed punching in alternative routes across Aberdeen that offered no time gain and often no sense. The sat-nav started to work against him, adding back the time it had subtracted. It was 15, 19, 22 minutes until they reached the university building. 25 minutes. Too many.
What's the delay?
Said Jess to nobody in particular. She fiddled with the radio buttons, trying to find the traffic reports.
What's the hold-up? It's just sheer weight of traffic. That's such a lame expression, said Nicky. Of course a traffic jam is sheer weight of traffic. What else would it be down to? There could have been an accident, said Tansy. But the jam itself would still comprise the traffic. So the problem is still the sheer weight of traffic. No, the volume of traffic slowing itself down is something completely different. But it's the same result. But then it's an inaccurate description.
Jess peered at the sat-nav.
Are we in the right place? I wouldn't have thought the docks would be near the university.
We have to get through the docks to get to the university.
You sure?
I'm sure, Jess. Ed tried to suppress the tension in his voice. Look at the sat-nav. There was a brief silence. In front of them, the traffic lights changed through two cycles without anybody moving. Jess, on the other hand, moved incessantly, fidgeting in her seat, peering around her to see if there was some clear route they might have missed.
He couldn't blame her. He felt the same.
I don't think we've got time to get new glasses, he murmured to Jess when they'd sat through the fourth cycle. But she can't see without them.
If we look for a chemist, we're not going to make it there for midday. She bit her lip, then turned round in her seat.
Tans, is there any way you can see through the unbroken lens? Any way at all?
A pale green face emerged from the plastic bag.
I'll try, it said.
Traffic stopped and stalled. They grew silent, the tension within the car ratcheting up. When Norman whined, they growled, "Shut up, Norman!" as one. Ed felt his blood pressure rising, even as the weight of responsibility for getting them there seemed to grow heavier. Why hadn't they left half an hour earlier? Why hadn't he worked this out better? What would happen if they missed it? He glanced sideways to where Jess was tapping her knee nervously and guessed that she was probably thinking the same thing. And then, finally, inexplicably, as if the gods had been toying with them, the traffic cleared. He flung the car through the cobbled streets, Jess yelling, "Go, go!" leaning forwards on the dashboard as if she were a coachman driving a horse. He skidded the car around the bends, almost too fast for the sat-nav, which actually started to burble, and entered the university campus on two wheels, following the small printed signs that had been placed haphazardly on random poles until they found the Downs Building, an unlovely 1970s office block in the same grey granite as everything else. The car screeched into a parking space in front of it, and everything stopped. Ed let out a long breath and glanced at the clock. It was 6 minutes to 12.
This is it?
This is it. Jess appeared suddenly paralysed, as if she couldn't believe they were actually there. She undid her seatbelt and stared at the car park, at the boys strolling in as if they had all the time in the world, some reading off electronic devices, others accompanied by tense-looking parents. They were all wearing the uniforms of minor public schools.
I thought it would be bigger, she said.
Nicky gazed out through the dank grey drizzle.
Yeah, because advanced maths is such a crowd-puller. I can't see anything, said Tansy.
Look, you guys go in and register. I'll get her some glasses. Jess turned to him.
But they won't be the right prescription.
I'll sort it. Just go. Go! He could see her staring after him as he skidded out of the car park and headed back towards the city centre. It took 7 minutes and 3 attempts to find a chemist large enough to sell reading glasses. Ed screeched to a halt so dramatic that Norman shot forward and his great head collided with his shoulder. He resettled himself on the back seat, grumbling. "Stay here," Ed told him, and bolted inside. The shop was empty, aside from an old woman with a basket and 2 assistants talking in lowered voices. He skidded around the shelves, past tampons and toothbrushes, corn plasters and reduced Christmas gift sets, until he finally found the stand by the till. Damn it! Why the hell hadn't he checked whether she was long or short-sighted? He reached for his phone to ask, then remembered he didn't have Jess's number. Fuck. 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 Ed stood there, trying to guess. Tansy's glasses looked as if they might be pretty strong. He had never seen her without them. Would that mean she was more likely to be short-sighted? Didn't all children tend to be short-sighted? It was adults who held things away from them to see, surely. He hesitated for about 10 seconds, and then, after a moment's indecision, he pulled them all from their rack, long and short-sighted, mild and super-strength, and dumped them on the counter in a clear plastic-wrapped pile. The girl broke off her conversation with the old woman. She looked down at them, then up at him. Ed saw her clock the drool on his collar and tried to wipe it surreptitiously with his sleeve. This succeeded in smearing it across his lapel. All of them. I'll take all of them, he said, but only if you can ring them up in less than 30 seconds. She looked over at her supervisor, who gave Ed a penetrating stare, then an imperceptible nod. Without a word, the girl began to ring them up, carefully positioning each pair in a bag. No, no time. Just chuck them in, he said, reaching past her to thrust them into the plastic carrier.
Do you have a loyalty card? No, no loyalty card.
We're doing a special 3-for-2 offer on diet bars today. Would you like...
Ed scrambled to pick up the glasses that had fallen from the counter. No diet bars, he said. No offers, thank you.
That'll be £174, she said finally. Sir.
She peered over her shoulder then, as if half expecting the arrival of a prank television crew. But Ed stabbed out his pin, grabbed the carrier bag and ran for the car. He heard,
"No manners,"
in a strong Scottish accent as he left. There was nobody in the car park when he returned. He pulled up right outside the door, leaving Norman clambering wearily back onto the back seat and ran inside down the echoing corridor.
"Maths competition! Maths competition!" he yelled at anyone he passed.
A man pointed wordlessly to a laminated sign. He bolted up a flight of steps, two at a time, along another corridor and into an anteroom. Two men sat behind a desk. On the other side of the room stood Jess and Nicky. She took a step towards him.
"Got them!"
He held up the carrier bag triumphantly. He was so out of breath he could barely speak.
"She's gone in," she said. "They've started."
He looked up at the clock, breathing hard. It was 12:07.
"Excuse me," he said to the man at the desk. "I need to give a girl in there her glasses."
The man looked up slowly. He eyed the plastic bag Ed held in front of him. Ed leant right over the desk, thrusting the bag towards him.
"She broke her glasses on the way here. She can't see without them."
"I'm sorry, sir. I can't let anyone in now."
Ed nodded.
"Yes, yes you can. Look, I'm not trying to cheat or sneak anything in. I just didn't know her glasses type, so I had to buy every pair. You can check them, all of them. Look, no secret codes, just glasses."
He held the bag open in front of him.
"You have to take them into her so she can find a pair that fits."
The man gave a slow shake of his head.
"Sir, we can't allow anything to disrupt the other..."
"Yes, yes you can, it's an emergency."
"It's the rules."
Ed stared at him hard for a full 10 seconds. Then he straightened up, put a hand to his head, and started to walk away from him. He could feel a new pressure building inside him, like a kettle juddering on a hot plate.
"You know something?" he said, turning around slowly. "It has taken us 3 solid days and nights to get here. 3 days in which I have had my very nice car filled with vomit and unmentionable things done to my upholstery by a dog. I don't even like dogs. I have slept in a car with a virtual stranger, not in a good way. I have stayed places no reasonable human being should have to stay. I have eaten an apple that had been down the 2 tight trousers of a teenage boy and a kebab that, for all I know, contained human flesh. I have left a huge, huge personal crisis in London and driven 580 miles with people I don't know, very nice people, because even I could see that this competition was really, really important to them. Vitally important. Because all that little girl in there cares about is maths. And if she doesn't get a pair of glasses that she can actually see through, she can't compete fairly in your competition. And if she can't compete fairly, she blows her only chance to go to the school that she really, really needs to go to. And if that happens, you know what I'll do?"
The man stared.
"I will go into that room of yours. And I will walk around every single maths paper, and I will rip it into teeny tiny pieces. And I will do it very, very quickly, before you have a chance to call your security guards. And do you know why I will do this?"
The man swallowed.
"No. Because all this has to have been worth something."
Ed went back to him, and then close to him.
"It has to. And because, right now, at this exact minute, I really, really don't feel like I have anything left to lose.
Something had happened to Ed's face. He could feel it in the way it seemed to have twisted itself into shapes he had never felt before. He could see it in the way the man was staring at him. And he could feel it in the way Jess stepped forward and gently put her hand on his arm and handed the man the bag of glasses.
"We'd be really, really grateful if you took her the glasses," she said quietly.
The man stood up and walked around the desk towards the door. He kept his eyes on Ed at all times.
"I'll see what I can do," he said.
And the door closed gently behind him. They walked out to the car in silence, oblivious to the rain. Jess unloaded the bags. Nicky stood off to the side, his hands thrust as far into his jeans pockets as he could manage, which, given the tightness of his jeans, wasn't very far.
"Well, we made it."
She allowed herself a small smile.
"I said we would."
Ed nodded towards the car. "Shall I wait here until she's finished?" She wrinkled her nose.
"No, you're fine. We've held you up long enough."
Ed felt his smile sag a little. "Where will you sleep tonight?"
"If she wins, I might treat us to a fancy hotel. If she loses..."
She shrugged.
"Bus shelter."
The way she said this suggested she didn't believe it. She walked around to the rear door of the car. Norman, who had glanced at the rain and decided not to get out, looked up at her. Jess stuck her head through the door.
"Norman, time to go."
A small pile of bags sat on the wet ground behind the Audi. She hauled a jacket out of a bag and handed it to Nicky.
"Come on, it's cold."
"So, is this it?" The air held the salt tang of the sea. It made him think suddenly of beachfront.
"This is it. Thank you for the lift. We all appreciate it. The glasses, everything."
They looked at each other properly for the first time, and there were about a billion things he wanted to say. Nicky lifted an awkward hand.
"Yeah, Mr. Nichols, thanks."
"Oh, here." Ed reached into his pocket for the phone he had pulled from the glove compartment and tossed it to him.
"It's a backup. Don't need it anymore."
"Really?" Nicky caught it one-handed and gazed at it, disbelieving. Jess frowned.
"We can't take that. You've done enough for us."
"It's not a big deal, really. If Nicky doesn't take it, I'll only have to send it off to one of those recycling places. You're just saving me a job." Jess glanced down at her feet, as if she were going to say something else. And then she looked up and hauled her hair briskly into an unnecessary ponytail.
"Well, thanks again."
She thrust a hand towards him. Ed hesitated, then shook it, trying to ignore the sudden flash of memory of the previous evening.
"Good luck with your dad, and the lunch, and the whole work thing. I'm sure it will come good. Remember, good things happen."
When she pulled her hand away, he felt weirdly as if he'd lost something. She turned and looked over her shoulder, already distracted.
"Right, let's find somewhere dry to stick our stuff."
"Hold on." Ed hauled a business card from his jacket, scribbled a number, and walked over to her. "Call me." One of the numbers was smudged. He saw her staring at it. "That's a 3. He altered it, then shoved his hands into his pockets, feeling like an awkward teenager. "I'd like to know how Tansy gets on. Please." She nodded, her face unreadable. And then she was gone, propelling the boy in front of her like a particularly vigilant shepherd. He sat and watched them, lugging their oversized holdalls and the huffing, recalcitrant dog until they rounded the corner of the grey concrete building and were gone. The car was silent. Even in the hours when nobody spoke, Ed had become used to the faintly steamed windows,
the vague sense of constant movement that came from being in close confinement with other people, the muffled ping of Nicky's games console, Jess's constant fidgeting. Now he gazed around the car's interior, at the long black hairs and ghostly trails of dried slobber across the middle of the rear seat where Norman had been, and felt as if he was standing in a deserted house. He saw the crumbs and the apple core that had been stuffed into the rear ashtray, the melted chocolate, the newspaper folded into the pocket of the seat. His damp clothes hung from wire hangers across the rear windows. He saw the maths book, half wedged down the side of the seat that Tansy had evidently missed in her hurry to get out, and wondered whether to take it to her. But what was the point? It was too late. It was too late. He sat in the grey, bleak car park, watching the last of the parents walking to their cars, killing time as they waited for their charges. He leant forward and rested his head on the steering wheel for some time. And then, when his was the only car left there, he put his key into the ignition and finally began to drive. Ed had gone about 20 miles before he became aware of quite how tired he was. The combination of 3 nights of broken sleep, a hangover, and hundreds of miles of driving hit him like a demolition ball, and he felt his eyes drooping. He turned up the radio, opened his windows, and when that failed, he pulled into a roadside cafe to get some coffee. It was half empty, despite it being lunchtime. In one corner, a short-order chef fried something unseen on a griddle dark with grease, his hat pushed back on his head. A couple of suited men sat at opposite ends of the room, lost in mobile phones and paperwork, the wall behind them offering 16 different permutations of sausage, egg, bacon, chips and beans. Ed grabbed a newspaper from the stand and made his way to a table. He ordered coffee from the waitress.
"I'm sorry, sir, but at this time of day, we reserve tables for those eating."
Her accent was strong enough that he had to think quite hard to work out what she had said. "Oh, right, well, I..." "Major UK technology company in insider trading riddle." He stared at the newspaper headline.
"Sir?"
"Hmm?" His skin began to prickle.
"You have to order some food if you want to sit down."
"Oh." "The Financial Services Authority confirmed last night that it is investigating a traded UK technology company for insider trading worth millions of pounds. The investigation is understood to be taking place on both sides of the Atlantic and involves the London and New York stock exchanges and the SEC, the US equivalent to the FSA. Nobody has yet been arrested, but a source within the City of London Police said that this was simply a matter of time."
"Sir?"
She said it twice before he heard her. He looked up. A young woman, her nose freckled, her natural hair teased and fluffed into a kind of matted arrangement. She was waiting in front of him.
"What would you like to eat?"
"Whatever." His mouth was the consistency of powder. A pause.
"Do you want me to tell you today's specials? Or some of our more popular dishes?"
"Simply a matter of time."
"We do an all-day buns breakfast."
"Fine."
"And we..." "You want the buns breakfast?"
"Yes."
"Do you want white or brown bread with that?"
"Whatever." He felt her staring at him. And then she scribbled a note, tucked her pad carefully into her waistband and walked away. And he sat and stared at the newspaper on the formica table. Over the past 72 hours, he might have felt like the whole world had gone topsy-turvy, but that had been a mere taster for what had been about to come. "I'm with a client." "This won't take a minute." He took a breath. "I'm not going to be at Dad's lunch." A short, ominous silence.
"Please tell me I'm hallucinating through my ears."
"I can't. Something's come up."
"Something?"
"I'll explain later."
"No. You wait. Hold on."
He heard the muffled sound of a hand over a phone, possibly a clenched fist.
"Sandra, I need to take this outside, back in a..."
Footsteps, and then as if someone had turned the volume up to full blast.
Really? Are you fucking kidding me? Really?
I'm sorry.
I can't believe I'm hearing this. I can't believe it. It's tomorrow, Ed. Do you have any idea how hard Mum's worked to pull it together? Deirdre, Simon, the Grahams, that couple from down the road they're always going on about. They're all coming. They're coming because Mum and Dad want to show you off. Do you have any idea how much they're looking forward to seeing you? Dad sat down last week and worked out how long it had been since they last saw you. December, Ed. That's 4 months. 4 months in which he's got more and more sick, and you have fucking well failed to do anything useful other than sent in some stupid fucking magazines. He said he liked the New Yorker. I thought it gave him something to do. He can barely fucking see, Ed, as you'd know if you'd bothered to come up. He likes bloody magazines if there's someone to read them to him. Mum gets so bored reading those long pieces that her brain actually starts to seep through her ears.
On and on she went. It was like having a hairdryer turned on full strength in his ear.
Mum is so freaking desperate to see you, she's actually cooked your favourite food rather than Dad's for their anniversary lunch. That's how much she wants to see you. And now, 24 hours before the actual thing, you just announce that you can't come. Just like that. No explanation. What the hell is this?
His ears actually grew warm. He sat there, closed his eyes. When he opened them, it was 2:40. The Olympiad would now be more than 3/4 through. He thought of Tansy in that university hall, her head bent over her papers, the floor around her littered with redundant spectacles. He hoped for her sake that, faced with a page full of figures, she would relax and do the things she was so plainly made to do. He thought of Nicky, sloping around outside, perhaps trying to find somewhere for a sneaky smoke. He thought of Jess, seated on a hold-all, the dog at her side, her hands clasped together on her knees as if in prayer, convinced that if she wished hard enough, good things would finally happen.
You are a bloody disgrace for a human being, Ed. Really?
His sister's voice was choked by tears. I know.
Oh, and don't think I'm going to tell them. I'm not doing your damned dirty work for you. Jem, please, there is a reason. Don't even think about it. You want to break their hearts, then you do it. I'm done here, Ed. I can't believe you're my brother.
Ed swallowed hard as she put down the phone. And then he let out a long, slow, shuddering breath. What difference? It was only half of what they would all say if they knew the truth. It was there, in the half-empty restaurant, seated on a red leatherette banquette and facing a slowly congealing breakfast he didn't want, that Ed finally understood how much he missed his father. He would have given anything just to see that reassuring nod, to watch that somehow oddly reluctant smile break over his face. He hadn't missed his home for the 15 years since he had left it. Yet suddenly he felt so homesick that it overwhelmed him. He sat in the restaurant, staring out of the faintly greasy window at the cars whizzing past on the motorway, and something he couldn't quite identify broke over him like the rolling of a vast wave. For the first time in his adult life, despite the divorce, the investigation, the thing with Deanna Lewis, Ed Nichols found he was fighting back tears. He sat and pressed his hands into his eyes and tightened his jaw until he could think about nothing other than the feeling of his back teeth pressing against each other.
Is everything okay?
The young waitress's eyes were vaguely wary, as if she were trying to assess whether this man was going to be trouble.
Fine,
he said. He had meant to sound reassuring, but his voice cracked on the word. And then, when she didn't seem convinced...
Migraine.
Her face relaxed immediately.
Oh, migraine. Sympathies. They're buggers. You got something for it?
Ed shook his head, not trusting himself to speak.
I knew there was something wrong.
She stood in front of him for a moment.
Hold on.
She walked over to the counter, one hand reaching up to the back of her head, where her hair was pinned into an elaborate twist. She leant over, fumbling towards something he couldn't see, then walked back slowly. She glanced behind her, then dropped two pills